And I think it's question time. Yeah, so open floor. Whoever wants to make a comment, say a question. Do you want to just give a name and then fire away?
Yeah, Graham Estock from Sheffield.
Sorry?
Hello. Yeah, I'm Graham Estock from Sheffield. Can you just say what you think the effect of Scottish independence would be on the Trident issue?
That question comes up at every meeting. Effect of Scottish independence. Well, I think it would be extremely beneficial from the Trident point of view, because the Scottish National Party is completely committed. It's absolutely their number one of their Ten Commandments to getting rid of Trident. And so I think it'd be impossible for the Scots nationalists to repudiate that position. They'd have to say that. That will result in an argument with the English-British government as to how and when, and no doubt it'll take two or three years before they actually negotiate that, but they will go. And there's nowhere else to put them. The British government is running around looking for a place to put them, and nobody wants them. They suggested they go in Wales, what's the big Haverford West or something, and the unwise leader of the Welsh Assembly said, oh yes, that's a good idea. Well, he was absolutely mangled by all the people in the Welsh Parliament. They don't want it. They don't want it. The Devonport is mentioned, but Devonport has got houses right down to the waterfront. It's not possible. So actually, be a wonderful thing if the Scots got that. The CND in Scotland is supporting the Yes campaign precisely for that reason. CND in down this side has not made a decision about it itself individually. Actually, I'm favourable for other reasons, because I think it would make us realise what a tin pot democracy we actually have down here. We might have to rethink all our democracy, but I'm not voting in the Scotch election, so I'm not very relevant. This thing is getting slightly in my way. I can move a bit of it. Admirable though it is. And there are men knitting these things as well somewhere around the country. There we are.
Very good. Another gentleman.
Alan Pemberton from Sheffield. I'm alert to the fact that many of our current MPs have constituencies that have people and large numbers of people in employment whose job prospects are dependent on the renewing of Trident.
Yeah.
How do we persuade those MPs that they can sacrifice those votes?
The job issue. I cast your minds back to 1945 when 3 to 4 million people were working in the armaments industry. 5 years later, hardly anybody was working in the armaments industry because there was a national plan. We have no national plan now, none at all. So the first thing is, if any serious government who's interested in disarmament is to have an alternative employment plan prepared. And that goes for the trade unions as well. But the short-term answer, I can see absolutely no reason why skilled engineers who can make 4 new Trident submarines can't also make 4 brand new hospital ships. Exactly the same sorts of skills are required, and I think it would be much more peaceful for the world to have 4 hospital ships running the Union Jack under the World Health Organization than 4 submarines. So there are alternatives, but there's very little will to look for alternatives. And I think that we need to be pressing for the kind of imaginative idea I mentioned, but pressing those things as well. I doubt whether the MP for Barrow will ever persuade his workers to change. But when CND produced a report called Oceans of Work in 1985 or 1986, which was prepared by an academic from Bradford Peace School, and it was a very good report, and it showed that Barrow skills could make deep sea submersibles, they could make locomotives, they could make all sorts of things engineers required. It came out one lunchtime, and by the evening, the Vickers management had already rubbished it in the local press. So I mean, it's not as if people haven't looked. So I can't answer your question. It's unlikely that alternative jobs will be found in the time scale that's needed. But I think there could be ways, and there should be ways. And if the Barrow MP loses his seat on this issue, well, too bad. There are other MPs who might have something more sensible to say. I don't know. But I don't think it was Bob Crowe,
he was very rude, actually. Bob, nice man, very nice man. But he was asked about this, and he's very blunt. He said, when they gave up capital punishment, no one went round wringing their hands about the fate of the hangman. And that's pretty rude. But actually, it's not a neutral thing to be building nuclear submarines. It's not like making a washing machine or electric iron. It's doing something that has the capability of annihilating hundreds of thousands of people. It's not morally neutral. And I think we should have the courage to say that.
Some time ago since I heard this, these things, but I always try to remind myself, and I've never been able to corroborate whether it's right or not, and I was wondering if you might be able to do so, but I always think of it when I come to one of these meetings and remind myself just what we're all looking at. And I seem to recall that if one of the most powerful weapons they had were to be exploded now over here, over this meeting house, the whole of Sheffield would vanish in the twinkling of an eye, in a flash of light, and Barnsley and Chesterfield would suffer in the blast. Are you able to say anything about that?
Well, the warheads on the current Trident are something between 5 and 10 times more powerful than the bomb that flattened Hiroshima totally. A mile and a half square flattened, and of course pollution and radiation are going on for years afterwards. So depending on the size of the bomb, I think exactly, but how wide the area is afterwards, I don't know. I'm not a scientist, and depends on the yield of the bomb, I suppose. But it would be devastating, and it would not just be devastating for people here and now, but for generations to come, because of the pollution that's going to be released. It would be catastrophic for humanity, not just for Sheffield. Oh, yes. Though Sheffield's important, of course.
Anybody else?
And the likelihood is not just that. Well, okay, do that one first.
I just wanted to add to the bit you said about the Labour Party being wobbly. I actually had an email from Paul Bromfield, who's the MP for Central Sheffield, today, to say that he'd signed the early day motion against renewing Trident.
Good.
So there are.
Oh yes. There are, and they're beginning to realise.
They're waiting to be lent on, as you say.
Yeah. They are. I've got Jeremy Corbyn is now in our church constituency, and he's absolutely down the line. John MacDonald, there are plenty of them. It's not a majority view. A lot of them abstained on the Trident vote or voted against in 06 or 07 when the first Trident vote came. So a substantial number of everybody already in that position, so which is encouraging, I think. I was going to say on the question of use, I don't really believe that anybody is mad enough deliberately in a calculating way to use a nuclear weapon anywhere. You'd be mad to do it. So I think the real dangers are the miscalculations and the accidents, of which we've had dozens and dozens and dozens, including at least twice when it was only thanks to once a Soviet naval officer and secondly a Soviet army officer, a colonel, that the Soviets were not told that the West was attacking them. And if they had been told, there would have been a response immediately from the Soviet Union, which would actually have been starting World War III, because they weren't under attack, but every indication was that they thought they were under attack. That's the seriousness of these things.
There's been a historic link with the civilian nuclear power program and the nuclear weapons industry. I was wondering if you could say anything about that in the light of Fukushima and the government wanting to build a new reactor at Sizewell.
Well, yes, the initial, I think it was Chapel Cross, was it? I've forgotten, but the Calder Hall, I think, the first British nuclear power station was supposed to be putting electricity into the grid. And actually, we now know it was there to produce the plutonium and for the first bombs. The Queen opened it with a great fuss and bother, but that's the reality behind it. I'm not sure now whether that link is as strong, because having had 60,000 nuclear weapons, there must be an awful lot of plutonium around to be used planted bombs somewhere in stores. So I'm not sure whether bombs depend now on nuclear power. Some people would say yes, some people would no. I've got other objections entirely to that, and that is the possibility of disasters. I believe Heysham power station is about a metre and high above the Irish Sea, and take only a tsunami over there could flood that. So the possibility of accident. But I think worst of all is that who are we to leave behind lethal material for thousands of years after we've gone? That's what it is. It's Lord Flowers, who chaired the first Nuclear Energy Commission, said before Britain goes anywhere near nuclear power, we've got to solve the waste problem. And nobody solved the waste problem. It's been buried and all that, but who knows how long it's going to stay safe in whatever underground containers they're going to put them. So that I'm personally against nuclear power. You can be in C&D and believe in nuclear power. I would think you'll be a minority of about 10% at the most, but it's never been part of the Constitution that you have to be against nuclear power as well as nuclear weapons.
Anyone else? Yes.
Bruce, I think the other problem with Trident is if you say it's going to cost 100 million, if you can individualise that so that for each member of Britain, or England, Wales and Northern Ireland, if you want to forget the Scotland temporarily, if you could say, well, it's costing you individually pounds in a year. But also, I read there was a floating jetty at Holyrock or Faslane that's costing 500 million. They can't cure the problems with it. It's going to cost... They haven't put a total budget on it, so it could be 600 or 700 million to get a floating jetty for the nuclear submarines. And yeah, if all these other costs are added in, your case would be much stronger. And the other thing we were querying was whether the Americans, in theory, control the firing of these weapons. Do they control the destination of these weapons as well? We don't know.
Yes, there's different ways in which you can present the financial figures in ways that will have more impact on people. And I agree with you, most people haven't a clue between a million and a billion, they're all much the same. And when you get to trillions, nobody's got the slightest idea what you're talking about. So it is, I perhaps any local group could easily do a cost estimate, bring it down to it. It would be a good thing to do, I think, be very good. You had another point, but I've lost it or something. You mentioned something else that...
We were just trying to be clear about exactly what the procedure is. If there was to be any use of Trident, when people say independent, what do they base the use of that word on?
Well, as I mentioned, the Mos deterrent. Each submarine's got 8 missiles, and the missiles are American. They're made in America, and they're serviced in America. We have to take them back every year or whatever and hand them over and get another set of missiles. But that's not independent.
Could some British prime minister or government actually, independently of a word from Washington, use such a thing?
I think they could, but what would they be pointing them at?
I think
physically they could order the captain of a Trident submarine to fire nuclear weapons. It could be an insane scenario, but it could do that. You have to have a sensible target to be aiming anything at. And I think the guidance systems are probably under American control, the satellite systems. So I think it's really such a long way off the screen, that one, for me. But they're not independent. The French have an independent nuclear weapon. They built it. General de Gaulle wanted independent. He wasn't going to depend on the United States of America at all. We did. And stupidly. I mean, it's a good reason for not having Trident, because it's not ours. We've become, in so many ways, we've become the 51st state of the United States, haven't we? And that Tony Blair showed us how to do that.
Just clarify the timescale of the early day motion against Trident in Parliament and the vote for renewing Trident in the context of the vote for Scottish independence, because I think if, as someone's mentioned earlier, if the issue of Trident in Scotland gets much higher on the political agenda, then it's going to have a much larger knock-on effect to discussing Trident in England, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the vote in Scotland is in the middle of September. That's the vote on the yes referendum, middle of September. It could have a dramatic effect on all the parties if that vote was yes. All the parties in terms of nuclear weapons would have a dramatic effect. At the moment, the timescale is Labour Party amendments this June, then there'll be a Labour Party conference in the autumn at which the manifesto, in theory, will be argued, and the manifesto will be produced. Whether it reflects the party opinion, I'm not sure, but it will be produced sometime before the election of 2015. The present plan is that it will be a final debate on Trident in 2016 in the House of Commons. It's all a bit of a farce because they're already spending millions, if not billions, on Aldermaston, on Barrow, and on Derby, where they already commissioned the engines. So it's a bit of a democratic confidence trick as to what's going on. But if the Scots appeared to say yes, or a substantial number said yes, I think it would really change opinion in the parties, which is one reason why the British government at the moment is spending such an inordinate amount of time telling the Scots what a disaster a yes vote would be. I'm honestly astonished they haven't brought up the Black Death, because everything else they've produced as a threat on the Scots, and it's actually beginning to annoy the Scots. I'm delighted they're getting annoyed. They've overplayed their hand far too much. Interesting, isn't it? The launch of the First World War celebrations, because that's what they are now. The First World War celebrations is going to be where? Not in Westminster Abbey, not in St Paul's Cathedral. It's going to be in Glasgow in August. Why in Glasgow? Because there'll be lots of Scots soldiers running about with kilts, blowing bagpipes, and saying how wonderful it is to be British. That's the whole point of it. And 8 weeks later, you have the referendum. They're not stupid. Well, they are stupid, actually, but I think it'll be counterproductive. And with any luck, I've got some young veterans from Afghanistan, veterans from Iraq, going up there to run a non-violent, polite, but an alternative to the celebrations that's going on of the First World War.
I just wondered if you could say something about...
Could you speak up for me a bit?
Sorry. If you could say something about the international campaign against nuclear weapons, which it feels to me like has developed a lot, and I'm aware that Britain, amongst a few other countries, has refused to go to the recent conferences. Yeah. And I just wondered if there was any mileage in terms of campaigning around that issue about
public opinion amongst in other states, the governments of other states, is now much more positively against nuclear weapons, positively wanting to take steps, like the Marshall Islands. Astonishing that they came in as they have done. The British government has done itself no service by refusing to go to the two conferences, to discuss the humanitarian consequences of nuclear war. The British government wouldn't go. I think it's a very stupid thing to do, because it wouldn't hurt them to go, but by not going, they look as if they're standing away from all the negotiations that are possible. So the climate is in our direction. Overwhelmingly, the United Nations General Assembly voted for this new negotiating body, which I think will be set up, whether we liked it or not, will be set up. So I think the climate is quite positive. And Secretary General of the UN has spoken very consistently about this. Even Pope Francis is very clear: nuclear deterrence is an immoral system, he said. So I think there's a lot of public figures are now much more vocal than they were. But otherwise, I'm not privy to much international negotiations. I know there are Global Zero, there's Abolition 2000, there's Parliamentary for World Disarmament, there's a whole series of different organisations all pressing this cause. But my focus has been what's happening here on Trident.
It's just a bit about, I suppose, where human nature is. But given that we're evolved and the arms race between predator and prey occurred, and we evolved into humans, cognitive, self-reflective consciousness, all that stuff. But we also have a sort of greed, hatred and delusion amongst it's brought up very much by our culture of consumption. But in that greed, hatred and delusion, that humans were attacking each other, and so the arms race developed there, it's led to all sorts of arms races, conventional, and then onto nuclear, the mutually assured destruction stuff. I just wonder how the ending of nuclear weapons would actually fit into that arms race, because there would be some greed, hatred, and delusion still there, so people could make them again.
Yeah, they could make them again, but if you have the kind of treaty that we have for chemical weapons and bacteriological weapons, it would be very difficult to make them again, because there would be instant right to inspect anything anybody's doing, and that's quite a good break. But there's also the kind of culture moves on. I mean, this country used to have battleships. One of the reasons we had the First World War was a competition in battleship. Nobody's arguing for battleships. It's sort of gone off the thing. Not off the boil. It's not even on the spectrum. We had all kinds of enemies. I think one of the things everybody's forgotten about the European Union, it was designed to make it impossible for the major countries of Europe to fight one another. And I think that's true. However much your deep psychology doesn't like the French or the Germans, nobody's going to fight them. The British, the Germans, the French, Italians are not going to go to war again. We've changed the political structure. So I think there are pessimists around who say, human nature is bound to produce something awful. But it also, look at the other way. We've actually achieved some incredible things as human beings. We don't have a private army up in Sheffield, I don't think, probably not. I come from Maringay, we don't have a militia. I can go out at night without a servant carrying a sword. We've actually changed thinking on lots of things. Hadrian's Wall is now an ancient monument. It's not a barrier between warring tribes. So I think we've got to be a little more optimistic. Canada and America will never go to war again. They did once. Norway and Sweden will never go to war again. There are lots of places. There are 20 countries now that don't have standing armies. And I think that we've got to be optimistic as well as realistic, because what you're saying is realistic, not pessimistic. I can't say it. Our job is to try and build that world, isn't it? That's what we're here for, not to sit around and watch it, but to build it. And that means a lot of effort by a lot of people. I'm astonished how little people know about the United Nations. That when in 1945 we signed the Charter, the first point of the Charter is to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. That's what the Charter was for. The level of ignorance about the UN and its possibilities is just astonishing. Why don't we elect someone to the United Nations? Why is it so normal that the Foreign Office runs it on our behalf? We elect someone to Brussels. Why don't we elect someone to the General Assembly have an opportunity of discussing things? You can't even get in this country, I'm a member of the United Nations Association, so I'm not knocking it, but you can't even get a copy of the Charter now in this country. You've got to get one from New York. The obvious thing, there should be, I think every secondary school kid should be given a copy of the Charter as they enter the secondary school, perhaps with a Declaration of Human Rights as well. There was a thing once called the Council for Education in World Citizenship. It disappeared 10 years ago. There's no such council now at all. Go back in history, those who can remember, the League of Nations Union, to support the League of Nations, had 450,000 members in this country. 450,000 members. The United Nations Association now, if it's got 8,000, I'd be surprised. But that's more or less where we are. So there's a wealth of work to do on public education in general about international affairs. And I leave that to somebody else. I'm sure there are UNA members here, or some of them, but please, we need that kind of general information as well. They've all had enough.
I just want to kind of put one question. You've been on a tour for a month and spoken in a lot of different places. I just wonder if you've got any sense if there are any new groups or different sorts of people, or if the campaign is taking off amongst certain different groups. I mean, just looking around the room, there's lots of people I know, there's lots of people my sort of age or even maybe a bit older.
No.
I just wonder, it's kind of partly from Ronan's question actually, really, how do we, or is this happening, that the question about disarming from nuclear weapons is capturing that imagination that's out there about peace in the broader sense? I just wonder if you've seen that coming through in your months.
It's all guessology.
I think
this is very interesting. This is bringing in all sorts of people who have not previously engaged in nuclear disarmament. I think it's quite an imaginative thing. It's not going to change the world that we've linked Bergfield and Aldermaster with a long string of wool. It's not going to change the world. But it makes people think as to what it starts the process. I think that's a very encouraging little enterprise that's going on there. What we have missed, I think, are 20-year-olds in large numbers. They're not around. That's to be quite honest, they aren't. That generation is not there, or they don't come to meetings, or whatever. But that's the fact of the matter. There's no reason for us to stop. But that's. But we, perhaps we should look and wonder why they're not there, and what can we do about it? What I've found is enthusiastic groups like this. I wouldn't call this a small group. I don't know how many you are, 50 people or something like that. It's not a small group. It's a significant group. Any MP would be delighted to get 50 people out to talk about anything. Believe me, they really would. So it's actually quite a significant group of people. But the one thing that people have woken up to on the way through this is, God, this has got something to do with me. It's not Bruce Kent solving the nuclear arms race. It's something I can do. And that's why I go on with simple things like the petition or the wool thing or whatever, or wearing a badge. There's something I can do, if it's seeing your local councillor, whatever it may be. So I think that willingness to rethink and do something more active. You get some of the old timer CNDs, God bless them, but, well, we tried hard, it didn't work, so it's all over. Well, no, I'm afraid you never get the whistle blown for the end of the game until it works. And I think it will work, and it's moving in that direction, and we all have to work at it. And small things matter. That's the important thing, not just big things. I've mentioned the churches. I'd love to see every church having a copy of the Methodist thing or the Quaker thing in the back porch. Why not? It's not difficult. You've got a list of churches here. You know where they all are. Or the public libraries. A notice of the libraries. All those things are within our power to do. And yet we're often wondering, why doesn't Minister so-and-so in Parliament do something when we ourselves can actually help to change the atmosphere? Sorry, long answer.
Oh, we've got one more question. Go on.
Have you been heartened by your tour out? Have you seen more younger folk out there coming to your meetings?
I've been very heartened by it. Very heartened that people really. My positive feeling is people want to do something, and. I'm not a great inspiration, but a lot of people say, oh, you've given us a new boost. You know, I've realised something I can do. And that's encouraging.
Oh, my goodness.
Sorry.
This is inspired.
Really,
let us set the question.
Inspiration, actually. the thing was, I think most of us here can remember the CMD in the 80s and when it was a massive movement, and you know, why that petered out, why did that happen? And I think the points about getting young people engaged is really crucial, and I just wondered, for example, is there a CMD on Facebook? Is there a
Well, I believe they have a very good Facebook, but I don't know about Facebook. It's not my generation, right. but I was at a meeting where the other night. What is that thing? Twitter or something? Well, they'd already Twittered already around the world. This the meeting somewhere or other. It was going around. It's not my generation, but it was happening.
Not mine either, but I understand that Sheffield CMD has a Facebook and a Twitter, but I cannot give you any other information about it other than it does exist.
Well, join the Antiquities Club with me, dear. Yes, no, I'm quite encouraged by that kind of thing. But had I remember going to Lockerbie a long time ago, one of the first walks, and there were a bunch of young people, and they had set up a scales in the marketplace, and on one side of the scales was human needs, food and all that, and the other side of the scales was what we're spending on war. And it was a very dramatic little thing, and they'd done it from their own sixth form college, and they would. So it's using imagination. We have, David and Wendy have got over there, a wonderful game. I don't know, have we played it in Sheffield? I'm not sure. But it's a game of bogus money, where there's coins, £1 billion, done up in silver paper or something, or brown, or £1 million, and you get a big tabletop like this, and you've got education, health, pensions, whatever on it, and you're given £100 billion in bogus money, and you're asked to put the money on the issues that you think are important. And I saw it first of all in Bradford. People were queuing up to play it. It's a very simple idea. Anybody could do it. You could do it here in Sheffield. It's a very, very good way of waking people up.
We have to stall for three separate events, so it should be coming.
Oh, you've done it already, have you? Oh, well, Sheffield's already ahead of the game. Yeah.
Bogus money.
Well, it's bogus money. Yeah, you're not going to get £1 billion from me, but I can assure you. But.
So, shall we call an end to the meeting? I'm sure Bruce will be happy to stay around for a few minutes if people want to talk and mill about. But it just remains to thank you very much for
pleasure.
Coming. And thank Wendy and David, who are at the back there, who've been on tour with Bruce, supporting him. And thank everybody for coming. And thank the local CND for organising the meeting. And let's close. Thank you.